This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
You're now in the Essential Zone, where we seek to be informative, inspirational, enlightening, and dynamic. But more importantly, we seek to be fair and balanced. There comes a time when the game tolerates no spectators, only players. There comes a time when we must recognize that our individual aspirations shape our collective destiny. There comes a time when getting in the game, despite the risks, despite the challenges, regardless of the cost, is simply the right thing to do. There comes a time when we must find our hearts, find our soul, and pursue our purpose for the greater good of all, for country, for humanity. There comes a time when we must manifest our true greatness. Yes, there comes a time, and that time is now. So let's get down to the essentials. The essentials. Serious radio for serious people committed to advancing the national conversation. And good evening and welcome to The Essentials, The Reset. We are on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. I'm your host, Hubert Edwards, and as usual, we're going to have ourselves a wonderful conversation. You may wish to join in on this conversation, and the numbers are 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259, our text line 422-4796. Last week, we had a discussion around economics. We looked at the recently published IMF report, Article 4 report, and, you know, we kind of dived into it and made some statements, did a bit of analysis, just trying to understand exactly what emanates from that particular report and the importance that it holds for the Bahamas, for the country. This evening, we are going to make a slight shift, connected, but a slight shift. The economics of crime. And I think there's a good place to start today would be the front page of the Nassau Guardian newspaper, where on one hand, the Deputy Prime Minister, Chester Cooper, is under the headline, Cooper says tourism brand remains strong. I'm very pleased to report that we are learning now, that what we are learning now is that despite some negative impacts we take seriously and must address, and remains, or continues, sorry, to be robust. And so that's coming from the Deputy Prime Minister. And on the very same front page, on the opposite side, the Prime Minister appears under the headline, Prime Minister says, he's not trying to censor the media. In an interview with Zenon News yesterday, Davis said, I was not dictating, I was making a comment, an observation. And I asked them that they should take a look at how other news carriers in other jurisdictions carry their crime report. We have examples of it. It's not that they spin it that way. So you would all be familiar by now with the fact that the Bahamas recently had the United States recently put out a report, crime report, and warning, which kind of gave the impression that the Bahamas was really, really unsafe. That's kind of the way it came across. When you look at the overall assessment in totality compared to other cities around the world, the Bahamas is rated no worse than many other major cities. It's at a level 2. But the spate of murders, especially coming out of December and certainly over January and right into February, I think we may be at about 25 now. I think that has caused some level of, you know, pressure. And the news reports have taken this, news reports, I mean local reports in the United States for the most part and other places. And I've taken this and run with it in such a way where one would have to agree that in many instances, the spin which has been put on it, the way it has been reported, gives the impression as if tourists coming to the Bahamas are just not going to be safe. That is not the case. The officials from the UK High Commission said they weren't worried. We heard statement from the Charge of Affairs for the United States, which says it's not quite like that. But that hasn't stopped the news reporters in the United States and elsewhere from just going about it. Some of them, I think, turn up here in the Bahamas. They may have been here for different reasons, and so there was certain footage which was carried. So it becomes a bit of a challenge. And so we have a circumstance here where you have the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, all of the persons who are leaders in the country at this point in time, in the ruling side, that is, are faced with this tension of trying to move the country forward positively, but is grappling with this negative aspect, which is crime, which really has its own set of knock-on effects. And so this is why we're talking about the economics of crime, not purely, delving into how crime can be valuable, and it is certainly valuable for some people. But there's an economics to it. The very fact that the Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister, and others are moving heaven and earth to get to a place where the news coming out of the various local dailies gives a better representation of the Bahamas as a peaceful location. Yes, the crime is there. Yes, the murders are there. But the Prime Minister is saying, can you put it someplace else? Can you not put it on the front page? That is always going to be problematic, every single time. The Honorable Prime Minister is not the first leader around the world, around the region, who has kind of proffered that discussion. I've heard it before. I think I've heard it right here in the Bahamas before. But it's always going to be problematic. Because the moment a leader speaks to anything that the press does, the pushback is going to be, are you trying to curtail the free press? So it's always one of those areas which, it's almost a no-go for politicians, really. It's almost a no-go for leaders. And rightly so, because the press represents, as they say, the fourth estate. And the fourth estate within this context would be you have the executive, you have the judiciary, you have the... jump out of my head just now, but you have the overall parliament. And the fourth one would be the press, the free press, which is very, very important, plays a critical role in this whole experiment called democracy. And so the Prime Minister, having said what he said, and having heard the pushback from persons, sought to make it very clear that I'm not in any way, shape, or form trying to censor the press. All I'm saying is, can we find a better way of doing that? Ultimately, the press will decide what it does, how it reports. The Prime Minister, with a better effort, is always going to be in a position of disadvantage as far as that is concerned. Because there's a tension here. And it's an important tension. It's an important tension between leadership and a free press. And the moment that seemed to, there are fissures which are created by a response to what may appear to be dictates. The Prime Minister say, I'm not dictating to you. But any response to statement made will eventually be cast in that light. And so one can expect that the press isn't going to respond the way the Prime Minister intended it to be. And the Prime Minister, in his wisdom, subsequently said, look, this is not what I am thinking about, really, we just seeking to create a better atmosphere which the press helps to create within a country, such that the country can be seen in a better light. My words. Why is this important? Because at the end of the day, there is an economics to crime. Either you look at it in a positive way, and by positive I mean the direct offshoot, because nothing about crime is positive. But for those who participate, who engage in crime, for the most part, there are at least a few persons who are positively, and by positive I mean they gain what it is that they set out to gain. Not that crime itself is a positive thing. But they're rewarded. Sometimes quite a bit. Sometimes many persons, even individuals who we would not suspect to be engaged, so engaged, they benefit too. So there's that side. And there's also the negative side, which we are grappling with here, where the crime becomes a tension against the positive of a growing economy. So there's a recognition that if crime continues as it currently is and is reported very fulsomely, it could have an effect on tourism. It could have an effect on other areas of productive development within the country. And so when the United States made that report, it became problematic for the country. And not just for the Bahamas. I followed and I'm following the developments in Jamaica, who had a similar circumstance in recent time. The report came out, and Jamaica is up in arms. And Jamaica is, or the persons within the Jamaica is saying, hey, you're only doing this because there are certain political developments which we didn't acquiesce to, or maybe some speculation there. But, you know, it's a little bit, feel like a little bit of a punishment, because an argument can be made that at some point in time, it may have been a little bit different, it may have been more, but the report wasn't so pronounced. So Jamaica, the Bahamas, is grappling with that. A colleague of mine drew to my attention that today, this morning, on the Jamaican media, the topic of discussion was the statements made by the Honorable Prime Minister Brave Davis. So Jamaica is watching the Bahamas is watching Jamaica, and the discussions are happening as to how do we deal with this negative news emanating crime circumstance. So we have these two parallel experiences. And some persons are of the view that, hey, you know, leave the United States alone. We can't do anything about it. We have a right to warn their citizens, so on and so forth. What we need to do is to go fix the crime. And that's, you know, in a way, it's a viable to be made. But one must understand and one must appreciate, or at least let's argue this in the negative. Let's assume that that report came out and not a single leader from any political divide says anything about it. How would you feel? Would you believe that you are being properly represented, country-wise, not in a political sense? Would you feel that the leaders of the country are doing what they're supposed to be doing? So there's a whole stream of bad news coming out there. Tourism is booming. Should we just have left that on nothing done, nothing, you know, just leave it untouched and assume that at the end of the day, it's going to be okay? Because these things don't go away. Now, one may argue, and this is kind of a point that I would make, is that oftentimes we get carried away in the moment of what the circumstance is, and we kind of lose sight in that discussion. We lose sight or we minimize discussions around the root cause. Because often I believe that the redirection of the narrative Because whatsoever is out there is a very clearly laid out plan, a very clearly laid out statement, which says we see it, we understand it, we accept it, but we're fixing it. There's nothing much else that you can do. The thing about crime really, though, is it's a circumstance that goes deeper than just the issue of, yes, we have a preponderance of murders in recent time. And yes, at this point in time, it's generating a lot of negative news, which we would wish not to experience. And yes, that creates a lot of tension and a lot of problematic circumstance for those who are in leadership. That we can accept and understand. So it creates this immediacy, this urgent need for a response, this urgent need for some type of a reaction. And because of the way it works, it doesn't leave a lot of room for, slow strategic response. It's a reaction in the moment. Something needs to be said, something needs to be done, mostly said to counter whatsoever is there. But what about the root causes? What about the deep-seated root causes of crime? The potential for crime to adversely impact tourism is evident. It's easy to see. It's readily accepted. The everyday guy who's on the street readily understands that persons killing persons over the road gets reported here in the Bahamas, gets reported abroad, and tourists stop coming. Yes, we understand that. We understand that when they do, it reduces the amount of monies made within the industry, within the hotels. It could affect job market. And that's never, ever going to be a positive thing for the country. But there's some deeper, insidious issues that we do not always contemplate in the moment, or sometime, at least not publicly, when it comes to crime. Because you have a circumstance where this crime becomes really a vicious cycle. So as a simple example, let's say you decide to, well, not you, let's say you inherit a store from your father. And before him, your grandfather and your great-grandfather ran the same store someplace in a community over the hill, without a name for the time being. And it's a vibrant store, very vibrant, and the area around it is vibrant. The community is clean. The houses are well in a great state of repair. The community is peaceful. Things are nice. And then all of a sudden, people start to, congregate around it, lofting. Then they start to spray paint it, mash out the glass. From time to time, they will break into it. And that store, which is kind of the center of activity within that community, the center of commerce, that's where persons come to buy and get their food. That's where the man who sells the peanut stops, because that's where people are and they buy. That's where lots of things happening for the community. So it's now under pressure, yeah? And business start to fall off because, you just cannot take the consistency of persons breaking into your business. You don't want to buy insurance, or you had insurance, and then because of the frequency, your premium goes up and you realize, well, I can't afford it no more, so you stop with your insurance. And so the area loses vibrancy. Your store, which was a beacon representing all of the good things of the community, is no longer in a state of great repair. It's in disrepair. And so things around it start to look blighted. You no longer take care of the grounds. So the people next door kind of like follow suit, right? And things start to go down. So property values starts to fall. the community is no longer peaceful. So there are no persons who are from the outside looking in and saying, well, you know, that's a nice corner to live on. I want to see if I can get a place over there to buy. That means you have demand for the houses in that era or the properties in that era. And consequently, the value is high. Now, nobody wants to be there. And so the value falls. And this is what is happening. Generational wealth is being eroded because of that act of crime. All of a sudden, the peace and quiet of the community disappears. All of a sudden, the social activities, which, you know, for the purpose of our scenario here, you know, operate all around that shop. Healthy concerts, for example, from time to time, people come together. Sometimes the church people come and they do the thing right there on the plaza or on the front of it is the center of social interaction within the community, but now it's dead. And so the community dies slowly along with it. But the people are still there. The people remain. The soul of the community is gone, but the people are still there. And they are now existing in a way which is fundamentally different. And that social shift, that fundamental social shift, starts to manifest itself in different ways. The young boys are now a little bit more delinquent. The young girls are a little bit more delinquent. Some persons now, all of a sudden, you know, you could go to X place and say, you know, give me a Y amount of food until Y time. I come back and pay. That isn't there, so budgets don't go as far. So there is social tension within the household. And these things, which, yes, I may be kind of stretching them, but they're really, I think, very plausible. These things which we do not readily talk about on a day-to-day basis then fuels and foments into something bigger, something more significant. And so now you have different type of crime. Guys getting into guns, and because people lazy and lazing around, you get drugs introduced into the community. So we find that we are at a place where if we are going to grapple with the crime and the impact that settles ultimately when there's a huge flare-up or at any point in time in the newspaper, on the radio, in the international press, I think we need to now start to step back and pay attention to some important, quote-unquote, small things. We need to look back into the community. We need to start to understand why is it that the persons who participate in these criminal activities do so. Now, one must not be naive. One must not be crazy. One must not speak from a place where idealism takes over and make things look better than they can possibly be. Because there never, ever is going to be a time when there's no crime in the Bahamas or any place in the world. It has never been and it will never be. But the situation is, how do you fix the fundamental issues which are impacting the crime? Is there a deeper economic variable which needs to be looked at? Because when the crime takes place, it has this knock-on effect. It has a cost-increasing effect on the normal way of living on a day-to-day basis. When the corner shop, if it, let's say it remains open, or the one further down the road remains open, when they decide, well, you know, we are not going to go away like the man down the road, but we're going to employ additional security. We're going to put in cameras. We're going to be super safe. And that adds an additional $100,000, $200,000 to their costs for the year. The people pays. All of a sudden, the goods and services that they provide becomes more expensive. So there's an economic cost to be borne by every single individual that interacts with that institution, with that business. The food you buy becomes more expensive. The fact that you have to now seek to pass out a portion of your already meager budget to make allowance for security measures puts you in, sometimes for some persons, in a deeper stranglehold from a financial point of view. So there are no easy way, there's no priceless way, there's no costless way of dealing with crime. I'm not an expert. I'm just exploring some ideas where, from my perspective, the way I see it and the way I think it should be done, at least the way the narrative should be had. Because in many instances, I believe, and not just here in the Bahamas, and not just now, we are fighting the symptoms, and we are leaving a lot of the root causes untouched. Now, is that an absolute statement? Absolutely not. There are many, many institutions which are designed to cause us to be in a better state from a crime perspective, to be safer, yeah. There's urban renewal, there are various institutions that are geared towards youth. There is, working with the police and other agencies designed to make that aspect of life better. But we're still, I believe, just kind of brushing the surface as it relates to the social aspect. And let me give you an idea what I'm speaking to. And this really ties into the whole big economic picture. If I take you back to the IMF report that we talked about last week, one of the things it said very pointedly is that the authorities, meaning the government and whoever else falls within that realm, needs to pay greater attention to the spend, that's money spent, expenditure on education, healthcare, and social transfers. There seems to be a view, and I think many persons may readily take a position on this, that the educational spend in the country is not necessarily churning out optimal value. I don't believe that most persons will disagree with a statement like that. Even the minister, I've heard overtures which says, hey, we're doing certain things, but there's much more to be done. We have ways to go. An education system, an educational system which is not optimal, and this is not a panacea, that you have a perfect educational system and you will have no crime. That's not the point I'm making. The point I'm going to try to make is that the more effective your educational system is, the more likely you are going to churn out more productive citizens, more numerate citizens, more literate citizens. And there is that likelihood that persons will gravitate away from activities which are socially reprehensible, crime, things which we would rather not see. And I don't think anyone would argue that there is a connection between crime and education. This is not to say that the persons who perpetrate crime are not smart people. In many instances, some of them are near geniuses. But the fact of the matter, like most other endeavor, everything requires cheap labor. Everything requires labor, or at least requires manpower, which can be influenced in a particular direction. And I believe that individuals who are not focused on doing other productive work, not focused on pursuing a career, not focused on being, just a general productive human being, productive citizen, productive resident, is always going to be more prone to be encouraged, some by people trying very hard and others just by the thing being available, to be encouraged to get into this. And this is where the economics kind of come in for that particular individual. I can't read, I can't write, or I can't do it at a level which gets me into the main job market. I need money. I'm a man, or I'm a woman. I know we always stereotype the men, but sometimes, you know, because of the propensity of that. But let's say it's a young man. He now has a girlfriend, and the girlfriend wants things. The girlfriend gets pregnant. He needs to take care of the child. What is he going to do? He has to make a decision. Now he needs to go, in my mind, get a job, maybe work as a helper on a construction site, some other thing. Some guys going to tell you, I can't do that. I can't stand in the sun all day doing that, and you're going to give me, at the end of the week, you know, $300. No, sir. I know an easier way, a better way of doing it. Greater risk to him, but I know an easier way of doing it. And so he moves in that direction, and all of a sudden, you have a circumstance where he is basically saying, I will go and possibly rob somebody. I might get caught. But the risk of me getting caught, I have assessed it, is low. And if I'm successful, I may rob someone and get $500 or $1,000 in a night. I work maybe for two nights. They call it work sometimes. And I may do $2,000 or more for a week. As opposed to me going someplace and slinging some buckets for the whole week, my back breaking, and then I only going to make $300. He may not have gone through the process in kind of that rudimentary way, right? But that's exactly what he's thinking. He's doing a cost analysis, cost-benefit analysis on exactly the decision that he's making. It may have been a little bit more in the moment, but that's exactly what he's doing. What's the risk of me getting caught? Well, I don't think I can get caught. We cool, we straight, and they will go out and do it. So what's the big point here? The big point is that the more of those individuals that the country is able to put in a position that moves away from that type of a thinking, largely because they're idle, largely because they lack the necessary numerate and literate skills, and so they gravitate towards a certain lifestyle. The more you can move persons away from that circumstance, the better it is that you are going to be able to fix, and is literally fixing some of the root causes of the crime. Let's skip over the spend on health and jump to the social transfers, as mentioned by the IMF. So social transfers, what are social transfers? Well, government inevitably is always going to take a little bit of my taxes and yours and put it together, and they're going to pay it to somebody else who is in greater need. For whatsoever reason, the person may be out of a job, the person may be looking for a job, the person may be indigent. Whatsoever the reason is, or the reasons are, government does that as a natural course. It's just a normal thing. When you look at the budget, there are always going to be allocation for social services. It's necessary. children get abused, people don't have no house, all of that sort of thing happens. And the government has a role to play in making sure that members of the citizens in the country are okay. So that's fine. You and I should feel comfortable giving up a little bit of what we have, we can afford, so that they can be better. That's fine. I have absolutely no issue with that. The point, though, being made by the IMF, and I read some things into this, is, hey, you can't just give them the money. They need the money. They need the help in the moment, yes? But you need to think about it just a little bit more. You need to think about it in a more fundamental way, in a more strategic way. Like, at the end of the day, why are we giving them money? In the first instance, don't get me wrong, a man needs bread. He needs bread right now. He needs to be fed. He needs to be okay. But once we get beyond that initial feeding, we need to be asking ourselves, how can we spend this money in such a way that his circumstance improve? And this is where we now start to tackle and pay very, very close attention to some of the social ills within the country, like overcrowding, too much people living in the same house. Now, you know, I'm not trying to be disrespectful or anything, but those are realities. Because when you have overcrowding, there are other things which come alongside with that. When you have a concentration of individuals in a particular locality, there's always the possibility of persons being tempted to do things. So let's take Miss Sue, young lady, maybe let's make her about 28, 29, yeah, a reasonable age. She has three children. She's a single mother, hardworking woman, trying hard day and night to make sure that those three kids are okay. She's working hard, but the circumstances are challenging. So, you know, they go to school sometimes, sometimes they don't. They're not, you know, always well-behaved. Sometimes she don't even know where they are. And because her money cannot get as far as she would like it to get because of the obligations she has, she looks to the government for support. And the government rightly gives it to her, as it should. And so in month one, she gets, in month two, she gets, in month three, she gets, and the children move to the next grade. But they're not doing well. I believe that this is where we flip this on its head, and social services and the whole machinery of the government now start to think, if we can change the trajectory of these three children's lives in a very positive way, in the long run, the country benefits. They benefit, the mother will benefit, and the country benefits in the long run. Because we have to make sure that they're productive. So there are going to be conditions tied to the social transfer. Are they going to school? If they're going to school, they go to school every day and they do well, maybe I should give you just a little bit more than you usually get because these kids are good. They're doing well. You need to buy uniform. You need to buy books. You need to ensure that they have breakfast, that sort of a thing. So the whole point is, rather than simply distribute for the purpose of satisfying physical needs, we have to look beyond that. We have to look up to the idea of, you know, sending young people back to school, making sure that individuals who didn't get that primary school diploma or the high school diploma, they actually get that. We need to start thinking about how persons may do that going back to night school. We need to start thinking about how persons may achieve certain things by going into apprenticeship. And as we speak, plenty of these things are there. Some of them are there. I just don't believe it's broad enough, it's wide enough to take in the concentration of need which is out there. And it's there. You know, some persons would tell you otherwise, and that's fine. I won't get into an argument with any individual who say, you know, Edwards, you don't know what you're talking about. I drive around. I see. I look. I know what I'm looking for. Or at least I see what I see when I see it. There are persons out there who need a little bit more. And I believe that we should be helping them. I believe that the arrangements, some of the arrangements within the inner cities need greater social intervention. And it is my view that when that happens, we are actually disrupting the economics of crime. On the front end and on the back end. On the back end, the negative is left untouched or left without sufficient intervention, we will have this adverse impact on tourism, adverse impact on other aspects of life, economic life within the country. On the front end, if we now start to make those shifts, we are now developing more productive, more better socialized individuals. And if we can make those changes, if we can effect those changes, I believe that the country is going to be in a better place. Not just, it's not unique to the Bahamas. It's not unique to the Caribbean. It's not easy to do by any stretch of the imagination. And government have limited resources to so do. The point, though, is for every spend, every dollar, we have to figure out a way of how we're going to strategically make that work. Because it's simply not the money spent on the back end through law enforcement, chasing down the criminals, getting them into court, getting them ultimately, if they're guilty, into prison, incarceration. That's not where the greatest value is going to emerge. Now, there are always going to be persons who fall through the system. As long as you have a prison, or at least the reason you have a prison is because persons will be going there. So there's likely to be persons ending up there. And there, too, needs to be programs which are going to help persons when they come back to society. The big point here is simply this. We have to find a holistic way of dealing with the issues which ultimately distill and terminate into our newspapers, on our radio stations, and in the international press. Because in a very serious way, in a very serious way, the impact there is important. Very important. But it's not as important as dealing with it at the front end, because at the front end, it's the individual, one by one. Individual. At the back end, we look at it as the collective impact on the country, the collective impact on the economy, the collective impact on the region. But at the front end, it's the determination of whether that young man, that young woman is going to grow up, get the opportunities to become a productive citizen in his or her own country. And that's where the focus needs to be. Because when you do that, it then becomes congealed. They, you know, block up together. And then the impact becomes more significant, because if we can change the environment within which the crime foments, if we can change the people, if we can change the mindset, if we can more effectively use the resources that we have to get greater outcomes, then certainly, in the long run, the circumstances are going to be different. We're going to take our break here, and when we come back, we're going to continue to highlight some issues which we believe may impact or at least inform the narrative around crime in the Bahamas. Our numbers again, 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. If you so desire, maybe you can join us on the other side of the break. You listen to The Essentials, The Reset. Don't move. Come right back. Essentials.
Always on the go? Missed the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
The new Guardian Radio app is here. Listen live to all our Guardian Radio shows and live video stream select programs in our studio. Get information about Guardian Radio shows and our hosts. Send messages, including text, email, and even call. All from our amazing new Guardian Radio app. Download it free today in your App Store for your Apple device or Play Store for your Android device. The all-new and improved Guardian Radio app.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
So, we welcome you back to The Essentials, The Reset, as we listen to Bob Marley. Bob Marley is the big thing in town these days. The movie's out. And he sings No Woman, No Cry. And oftentimes in these circumstances of significant upheaval with crime, especially murder, there's always a woman someplace crying. There's always a mother, a grandmother, a wife, a girlfriend, a sister, an aunt, a niece, someplace always wailing. Always strike me as interesting when you follow the news, when you listen to the reports and the various news houses are rushing to see who is going to be on the scene first. The people who are wailing and dropping in the street and have to be consoled and taken up and sometimes given medical assistance, this just never ever include a man. I don't know why. It's always a woman. The woman bear the brunt in many instances of the emotional impact of these things. Maybe men have the ability to do it differently, or at least they don't do it publicly. But right there, out in the public, raw, vulnerable, the women are wailing. And they're crying. And they're asking society, regardless of, let's not get into the micro of the circumstances, because in some instances, one could make the argument, you know, you kind of knew, or at least you kind of should have appreciated that this was coming. Those are the realities. Some of them know who their sons are, or their boyfriend are, or their cousin or brother. They know. But be that as it may, they're out there bearing the emotional scars of crime within their community, within their country. And as they lament in the streets, we watch, we listen, the lights then get turned off, and we totally forget. And we go away on our merry business until the next one. Then we tune in and we watch the Facebook Live and we listen, and it repeats itself. I think the song is instructive. While it, you know, in its essence, it's a totally different message, it can be applicable here. In that, we need to remember, more of us need to remember, and I'm now speaking to the people who made it out, went elsewhere, did well. However you did it, none of my business. You went to school, you studied, you worked hard, you got opportunities, you were associated with certain organizations, you got into politics, whatsoever it was. No matter. You made it. I believe, and this again isn't unique to the Bahamas, but I believe that there isn't enough individuals looking back, stretching a hand. Because, you know, at the end of the day, crime is crime. What is crime? It's doing something which is illegal. And oftentimes, because some of us are not running in the streets and toting guns and doing certain things, we're not seen as criminals. But, you know, even some of us in jacket and ties and looking nice and cool, some of us are actually involved. And the streets watch us. The people know. They see. Part and parcel of us ridding ourselves or fixing this crime situation is arresting that type of a circumstance. So on one hand, persons need to go back and give a lending hand, a more social impact. And on the other hand, they need to be zero tolerance towards all things criminal. We have some caller on the line. Caller, go ahead. You are in the Essentials. Carla, go ahead. You're on Essentials. Carla, go ahead. No?
Hey, good evening. How are you doing here, bud?
I am doing great. And you?
I'm doing good, you know. I'm doing good. Thank you. It's been a minute here, bud. Nonetheless, interesting topic that you're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
That you're continuing to discuss. That's beating the Bahamas badly at this time. In the instance of crime, I was listening for a while and found myself thinking, you know, as it relates to long-term solution, because there are different tiers of solutions to crime, as you should be able to think through, Hubert, as a thinking man. You know, there's a short-term tail of crime, medium-term tail of crime, a long-term tail of crime, right?
What would those be?
And I'm going to get into it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that you were discussing, in my view, would bring about some level of reduction in crime, right? But I still think that would only bring about the band-aid approach with crime. I think that even in the best of educational environments, I think that even in the best of social welfare environments where the net is cast so wide that it's able to assist, I think that those types of approaches would still only lend to short and medium-term solutions to crime, but the crime will continue to reoccur and lend itself to records like what we're seeing now. I believe, Hubert, in order for us to arrest crime, we have to go even deeper. If you look at the country in the 50s, 60s, 70s, before the drug era came around, primarily in the 80s, Hubert, we had a society where... Can you hear me, Hubert?
I'm hearing you. Go ahead.
We had a society where education was not the predominant factor in our country, certainly back in that time. Even in that time, and of course, that would have changed with the introduction of majority rule government. That would have changed, right? In the Stalin and Pinlin era, Indiana era, with all the men and the great women who made all the sacrifices to empower them. We didn't have predominantly in our society an educated behemoth, but we certainly had a society where crime was far less prevalent than it is today. Crime was not a factor back in those days, and if you had levels of crime being committed, it was certainly not to the tune of murder, right? Mm-hmm. We have, I guess, a little fist fight, a rock and bottle fight, that kind of thing. But we have elevated to the point where the loss of life is the order of the day as a means to, in the criminal mind, as a means to ending wars, right? And so I believe we have to get back to the basics of value, Hubert.
Mm-hmm.
Value of life, value of respect for each other, love in the community, love in the home, Hubert, a reverence of God and men of God. Of course, that's another conversation in itself because, you know, we have a lot of people in the society who believe that a lot of persons who represent the court don't hold a standard, right? And so they've taken their eyes to a large degree from what I've seen over the last 20, 30 years, have moved their eyes off of men of the cloth because a lot of persons feel that there's a great lack in that division.
So
but
where
I believe...
Let me ask you quickly. Where have they turned their eyes?
On themselves. On more worldly solutions rather than godly solutions because they feel that the people they are turning to in many instances of the cloth are doing the exact same things, but on a slick, as the young people like to say,
mm-hmm.
or behind the curtains, as the old people used to say and still say. And so a lot of persons don't feel that many of the persons who raise themselves as people of the cloth, like the elders used to back in the day, could be trusted any longer. And so people have taken matters into their own hands. They're looking unto themselves.
So,
and they're also looking around where they lack.
Yeah, so
they're looking around at other worldly people to help to fill those gaps.
Yeah, so it's your belief that we have a religious problem.
That's a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a serious value problem in the country.
We don't
value each other. We don't value life.
Mm-hmm.
We don't value respect for one another. We don't value being agreeable to disagree and not disagreeable. Those things, in my view, Hubert, were the matters that carried us through even when there was a lack of education, even when there was a lack in economic empowerment in those early days of the Stalin and Pinlin, Arthur Han and those governments. Because there was a lack even in those times. But we didn't have the problems, the social outcomes, that we have in this day and age where we have certainly a lot more education abound in the country, right? Where we have a national institution of education and other institutions throughout the country, where we have economics abound even though it's not at the level where it should be, mm-hmm. it's still a bound in comparison to when you look back in those times. Okay. We have a severe lack of value.
Okay, let me engage you a little bit here, right? Because one of the things I think you've taken away from my discussion is that I make the point that education fixes the circumstance. You contrast the educational level today as it was back then. My question to you is, how would the individual of yesteryear fare without the requisite level of educational exposure compared to today? Is that individual going to be better off or worse off?
Well, that's a very good question, Hubert.
I'm looking for a direct, good answer from you on that particular question.
Yes. Even in today's environment where education or so-called classroom education
mm-hmm.
abounds, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have circumstances in governments throughout the country, throughout the decades, of great failure, Hubert, of great failure, right? And so education alone won't cut the mustard. I believe that if you juxtapose the men from that era of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, planned them in this era, I believe we would be better off, to be quite frank.
Which
I believe they would fare a lot better.
Which men you speak of?
I'm saying the men of the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
You mean all the men of the 50s, 60s, and 70s?
Men and women of that generation.
Mm.
Because Hubert, the primary thing that they had going for them was great character and integrity.
Okay.
Great character and great integrity, Hubert. That even where they may have lacked in classroom education, they were able to learn as they ran along. Mm-hmm. They learned as they ran along, and they were able to apply that knowledge that they gathered as they ran along. Nothing must have changed in that regard from the men of that era to today, because you still have that going on today, Hubert. What we lack in many instances, Hubert,
mm-hmm.
is integrity and character when you answering that question that you asked me as it relates to how the men of that era would feel in this day and time.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. In my view, Hubert, that's where we are lacking severely, my brother.
In character and integrity.
Character and integrity, because even if you look at from the family unit,
mm-hmm.
Hubert, right? Single home families always dominated our country, right? Even in that era,
yes.
even in that era,
mm-hmm.
right? And it still does today, mm-hmm. right? The major difference, Hubert, character and integrity in the way they conducted their affairs, in the way they seek to raise their family, in the way they did not run away from their responsibilities for the most part.
Let me ask you something, Anton, because I agree with you on the integrity and the value. Certainly that is important. Where I disagree with you on is, and let me use this analogy, right? So there is a house someplace in the Bahamas. I don't know exactly where it is, but there's a house someplace in the Bahamas that was built by one of your men or women from the 50s, yeah?
Mm.
Maybe a two-bedroom, three-bedroom clapboard house, yeah?
Mm.
At the time, it was the gem of the street, right?
Mm.
In that same house lives three generation relating to that same person.
Mm.
Yeah, the same house. And so you may want to stop and ask yourself the question, you know, why are they still there? Why is it that the man of the 50s could have built that and they now have to coexist in this really cramped environment? At what point in time did they lose the economic wherewithal to do it for themselves? At what point in time did they lose the drive? At what point in time did they lose the ability to see things differently and became comfortable with such a lifestyle?
That's another very good question, Hubert. And I was smiling to myself profusely, internally, as I listened to you flesh the question out. And Hubert, believe it or not, the men, the political leaders, the leaders in the country of the generation that I spoke to, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, Hubert, they had, even in the 80s and to the earliest part of the 90s, they had a prime advantage of access in the country that no longer exists, Hubert, on a small, medium, or large scale, except for certain segments of society, where we as a government today have still not broken that back, although we know it exists, although we promised to. We have yet to deliver on that. And let me go back to the question now after making that statement, Hubert.
Yeah.
And so, for instance, there was a great access to land in our country.
We have some other
for the men and women.
Anton, wrap it up. We have some other callers, so we want to get some.
No problem.
Yeah,
there was a great economic access of land to men of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even the first part of the 90s. Hubert, to access land in our country today, when you look at, when you juxtapose that against the requirements from the commercial banks, Hubert,
okay,
it almost makes it impossible, my brother.
I take
when
your
you
point.
Look at the cost.
I take your point, and I'm going
and,
to speak
and
to
political
that.
Decisions.
Yes.
Political decisions, I'll end with you. Political decisions, Hubert, have led to two and three generations. Political decisions of the 90s have led to two and three generations having to still reside in one home.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity,
Thank
my brother.
You so much. We have another caller. Caller, you are on the Essentials, the Reset. Go ahead. We have another caller? No? No. Okay. So, Anton, you made some interesting points. I really don't want you to walk away thinking I'm saying, you know, get a more educated person and you fix everything. All I'm saying is simply that the type of circumstances that exist back in the days, those individuals would need greater levels of education, greater levels of exposure, greater level of creativity, greater level of access, as you alluded to at the end of your discussion, to make it. Things have changed, but in many ways, opportunities are not changing fast enough for some persons. But let's go back to where I wanted to take this, because the educational part and the development is only one side. The other side is, if you do crime, you should go to jail if you're guilty. If you do crime and you're found guilty, you should go to jail. If you do crime and other persons know that you do crime, somebody should report you. If you do crime, the system should not protect you in any way, shape, or form. My point is, at every single level of society, where the law is transgressed, those transgressors should be punished. So they should go through the police system. They should then go to the courts, which will decide, okay, are you guilty, are you not guilty, and sentence them, and then they should go to jail or prison. And in the prison, there should be mechanism for reform, to fix them, to make sure that when they come back out into society, they are good, functional persons, not to go to a place where, you know, they have been punished and they live like subhumans. No. We have to figure and we have to get to the place where we understand that because somebody made a decision, a wrong decision, yes, to, you know, rob me, to take my car, or whatever it is, and he goes to jail and he's found guilty and he goes to prison, it doesn't take away his humanity. He's still a human being, in the fullest regard. And yes, we understand that, you know, justice systems are built on various elements. So, you know, you have retribution, incapacitation. We talk about prevention, rehabilitation, and of course, restoration. So in retribution, we seek to really just punish the individual for the crime which they participate in, which we have convinced them and ourselves that they're guilty of. They go to the legal system and the court said, you are guilty, retribution, so we can sentence you to a long time in prison. And the reason we're going to put you in prison for a long time is because we want to incapacitate you so you won't be doing any more crime. And maybe the ultimate incapacitation is the death penalty. If you're a murderer and we believe that you're guilty, we'll just take you one time and be done with that. I don't have anything against the death penalty, to be honest. I'm not going to be one who's rushing to kill anybody. But if you follow through the process and the process says this is it, then that's fine. There's always the possibility of us being wrong. But if I am the accused and I go through the process and they find me guilty, I'm going to get it. It's just the way it is. We would hope that the investigations, the process are done in such diligent and careful way that we're not making mistakes, yeah? But we have to get to the place where we're very serious with crime. And we're very serious about managing future criminal activity. So when a guy goes into prison, we have to get serious about rehabilitation. It have to be a very significant part and parcel of what we do. There's no sense sending a young man or woman into prison who comes back out even more hardened than they were, who, because of their experiences in that place, takes on almost a subhuman persona. Those persons are just going to do more harm. So rehabilitation is going to be fundamental. I am of the school which says, for example, that persons who are involved in white-collar crime, corruption, and all that sort of thing, they are going to go to jail. They're going to wave to the guys in jail. And they will wave to the guys who are in jail when the guys who are in jail leave. They're going to be there for a long time. We have to get to the place where we start to build a society which screams zero tolerance at all levels. When you run the red light, when you have a traffic infraction, you should pay the penalty for that, whatsoever the penalties are. Regardless of whether your cousin is the police officer or you know the commissioner or you know a minister, it doesn't matter. There is, as we indicate, economics to crime. Some people benefit by being enforcers and they're able to be, you know, get a thing. But at the back end, like we are seeing today, like we're seeing over the last couple of weeks, that eventually creates a critical mass, a tipping point, which has an adverse impact for the country, for everybody. So if we're going to solve these problems, if we're going to get to the place where the country is in a better place, then zero tolerance means zero tolerance. You do something wrong, you should be punished. Because we cannot have a circumstance, as I spoke about earlier, the economics of the situation. We cannot have a circumstance where people, young man, young woman, old man, old woman, is making a decision to be involved in crime and saying, you know something, having regard for the costs involved and the fact that I may be able to get off, pay my way out, I'm going to be involved anyway. We have to get to the place where persons believe that when they do the wrong, the punishment which comes behind that is going to be significant, is going to be certain, is going to be sure, and there's going to be no mercy other than the normal mercies which are required from a human perspective. We have a call on the line. Go ahead.
Hubert.
You back.
Forgive me, but you said something, and I just wanted to add the point on it that is needed to make it complete,
mm-hmm.
if I may, please. Just one point.
Yeah, go ahead quickly.
Thank you. You were talking about addressing criminally minded individuals as a whole,
mm-hmm.
and what is needed to support them that when they are completely paying their penance,
mm-hmm.
or their sentence, that they are a better human being,
yeah.
a rehabilitated human being,
mm-hmm.
who is educationally empowered to survive in a society.
Empowered,
right?
In some way, yeah.
Right. The part that's missing from that conversation, and I only call back because I believe your show is one that you use to seek to educate people, and I appreciate that. It always has been, whenever you participated on daytime talk shows. The part that's missing, though, Hubert, is we have an unforgiving society, Hubert, and in order for, if we're going to consider the comprehensive approach to reducing recidivism to an irreducible minimum, we must, or the government, must be able to successfully partner with private sector,
mm-hmm.
and public sector to create that direct path for persons who either are hardened criminals and made mistakes over and over again, and they're at that one point where they decide enough is enough, or criminals who made a bad choice and want not to make that choice again,
mm-hmm.
and it's going through the process. The government has to be able to work through its own public sector channels and partner directly with private sector at all levels, from the top to the bottom, because it can't just be a bottom-level approach. From the top to the bottom, to create a direct path that after persons have reformed, they have an access point to reintegrate into society successfully and not have to sit around in the home or on the block with nothing to do and no option among being made available to them. We're having a trying time, Hubert, with persons who haven't committed crimes getting access. Judge less persons who have. Thank you for the opportunity. God bless you.
I agree with you. But, you see, this is where the institutions themselves is important, right? So government can work as much as it wants with creating avenues for improvement. If the individual who now steps out of prison wasn't at the time they spent in prison with a 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, given certain skills, if they didn't have the skills, or if they did have skills, given an opportunity to enhance that and stay current, to study whatsoever it is that they do, some sort of a trade. If you do not make that individual better, then solving the circumstance when they are out is going to be that more difficult. And that's why I said at the top, it has to be a holistic thinking. How are we going to spend the monies that we have to spend anyway to ensure that it is done in the most effective manner? Otherwise, you're going to force the guy to make another decision. He's going to come out and he need to eat, he need to sleep, he need to live. He's going to make another decision. How can we get to the place where crime is not impacting our front pages and not impacting our main economic organ being tourism? That is important. But also, what is important is how are we going to look at crime which impacts urban blight? Because there's significant urban blight taking place. It is. How are we going to do that? How are we going to create a path for the regeneration of generational wealth? Anton spoke about the men and women of the 50s and 60s who were able to do fantastic things, to build this house on smarts and creativity and through blood, sweat, and tears. But those houses which ought to have been foundation for casting forward generational wealth has stopped being that because they're in eras where the values just plummet. They don't hold no value. Certain things won't happen for those persons unless we start to fix these things. So it's not simply, you know, catch him, lock him up, that type of, don't report it, that type of a thing. You know, let's respond when the news, it's way beyond that. It's a complex set of circumstances which have to be dealt with on the back end and the front end, both ends. The bad news is out there. You can't sit down and wait to fix that. You need the leaders to step out as they did at the risk of criticism. And they are going to be criticized by one group or the next. But they have to do it. There's no question about doing it. If they don't, you're going to be in a worse circumstance. But having done it as the Deputy Prime Minister said, and let me just read this again. He says that despite some negative impacts, which we take seriously and must address, our tourism brand continues to be robust and resilient. So that is there a recognition that, yes, at the back end, this thing is impacting the country. It's impacting the normal way of doing business. It's impacting the combat, the reconsolidation. It is impacting the good things which are happening to the country. But in that same statement is a recognition that there's some things in the background which needs to be fixed. And so the effort, the solutions, the initiatives, the programs, the plans need to go to the places where they need to go. Where the young man is today, just being in an environment is being influenced by an older man who is going down the wrong path, morally. And is likely, therefore, without the requisite levels of intervention, proper intervention, he's likely to go down that path too, and then become a critical player, an important player in this bad news which filters out in our newspaper a couple years down the road. We have to get to the place where we start to pay attention to the individuals. And I always say this, I always lament this. The Prime Minister, I believe at the start of his administration, and he very well still may be, was onto something when he said economic dignity is going to form a foundational policy of my administration. He said that. At least maybe not in those words, but my words. He said that, and that was, I believe, an important thing. To what extent have that not gone through fast enough, deep enough, solidly enough, is a question worthy of asking and reflecting. We have a call on the line. Caller, go ahead.
Yes, good night, Mr. Edwards. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing great.
The question you asked is not a critical one, Mr. Edwards. It's kind of why I called, too. You were asking why hasn't these things reached where they need to go and stuff like that, and we need to focus on certain people, et cetera, right?
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, Mr. Edwards, everything rises and falls on leadership. You know, and
I'd agree with that.
It troubles me when I see the citizens trying to figure out solutions to problems that we pay people for, you know, who people, you know, ran, that on the basis that they can help us solve these problems, et cetera. But, you know, we don't focus on them per se. We focus on the symptoms of the problems, and we talk about those things.
Yeah, but
and we even go to the point sometimes
stick
of...
Stick up in quickly.
We have individuals who...
Hold on. We don't have a lot of time, so why don't you stick up in quickly? I just want to say something to you, right? The truth is that that type of a sentiment that we pay some people to fix these problems, right, while the citizens worry about it, I don't think is the right way of thinking. The fact of the matter is there's some people, yes, who are getting paid to provide leadership, but that leadership is the movement of the... It's not a diverse effort away from... People are supposed to be engaged in this process too.
The people are supposed to be engaged in the process, Mr. Edwards, to the point where we hold those who we elect accountable, Mr. Edwards. You know, I feel as if...
It's more than accountability. It's active participation and collaboration with them.
Mr. Edwards, I just feel as if we fail when we refuse to put pressure on the place where the responsibility lies. Okay. All right? You know, I sit back, like I said before, and I watch individuals, I listen to individuals discuss the problems, but yet still, they don't focus. Like I said, everything falls and rises on leadership, Mr. Edwards. And if that's the case, then why is not the discussions more focused on leadership? Why don't we try to focus on having in leadership people of integrity and individuals who we know are upright character, instead of knowing that we have individuals in the House who represent us who themselves don't follow the law? You see, that is where we need to start, Mr. Edwards. As long as we continue to talk about the symptoms, we will never get anywhere. We need to put the pressure where the pressure is supposed to be placed, and that is on leadership, because you admitted just now that everything rises and falls on leadership. So why are we discussing the things that we are discussing when that's supposed to be the responsibility of leadership? Our responsibility is to make sure they do their job. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much. I'll align myself with your statement. Everything rises and falls on leadership. But leadership at a national level is not limited to the persons who are in government at all. And every single individual at some level within the country has a role to play. And your leadership may be simply speaking to a young man, encouraging him to do something different. When you're aware of illegal activities, to report it. To not have information and keep it from the police. To not do anything which is illegal yourself, like, you know, break the light and try to bribe the police, even if the policeman is receptive to it. To live in such a way as a citizen or resident that you are lawful in all regard. Now, this isn't going to solve all of the problem by you doing that by yourself. But if everyone takes that approach, the critical mass is going to be there, the environment is going to be created, and those who you speak of will necessarily see and respond to the sentiment that you're giving off by your action. But oftentimes we are calling on persons to march to a higher music, if you will. But we won't march to it ourselves. We don't even have the discipline or the commitment to be lawful at all. Many of us. But still, we put ourselves in a circumstance where we say, you know, go fix it. Go fix what? You know, we, all of us, have a role to play as parents, as friends, as family, as colleagues, as, you know, just neighbors. We have a role to play. And the whole idea is, as we come to an end, is at the end of the day, all which is left undone, all which is left untouched, all which solution does not come, engage, and interact with, ultimately comes back to haunt us as a country. The economics of it is simply this. In very clear relief, as the country struggles out of the circumstance it was in, we are faced with something internal which could destabilize that. crime leading to international negative sentiments. And we have to figure out, as a country, how we're going to fix that. Leadership, yes, is needed. Leadership should step forward and make sure that they lead the charge. But every single individual has a leadership role to play in that process. Let's lead ourselves, because the highest form of leadership is self-leadership. And we leave it there for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for listening in. You've been listening to The Essentials, The Reset. All we're trying to say is simply this. There's a price to be paid. There's an economics to crime. Back and front end, positive, negative, there it is there. And we have to put ourselves in the position, if you're very serious about country, if you're very serious about moving a people forward, you have to put yourself in the position to make and arrest those problems. We always like to end by saying, do not allow your greatness to become a victim of your unwillingness to change. All that's left to be said is, be good, walk good, one love, and Ubuntu. Good night.
Buffalo soldier, dread like Rasta. It was a buffalo soldier in the heart of America, stolen from Africa, brought to America, fighting an arrival, fighting for survival. Taken from my